powerless to do anything other than to ask the UN to condemn the Israeli West Bank settlements as being against international law and the UN Resolution 242, and to request the US to require Israel to return the occupied territories, all of which Israel simply ignored. At the same time, the Arabs played into Israel's hands by carrying out sporadic acts of terrorism and by allowing the extreme faction of the PLO to continue to demand the destruction of Israel. PLO chairman Arafat was prepared to recognize Israel's existence in exchange for the Israeli withdrawal from the occupied lands. He was fearful, however, that if he made such an open concession without an Israeli commitment in return, his life, or at least his leadership of the PLO, would be in jeopardy. For that reason, Arafat was forced to perform a high-wire act that frustrated all efforts of mediators to pin him down to a specific and firm position. While Arafat's vacillations exasperated the forces working toward peace, it was the best of both worlds for the Israelis. The Israeli strategy was to win the game by ball control. By simply holding on to the ball, the occupied territories, and by progressively increasing their grip on the territories, by building new settlements on Palestinian lands, they would eventually win the game. With enough settlements, the West Bank and Gaza would belong to Israel by a fait accompli. Israel didn't need or want a peace conference, because it could only result in Israel having to give up something it had already decided to keep. With lavish help from the US, Israel had now become, by far, the strongest military power for its size in the world, and it had defeated the Arabs in four wars. As we have seen in Chapter 3, the Jewish Underground had written the book on terrorism, and how to rid a country of an oppressive occupying power without the use of conventional military forces. Begin and Shammy have gained a well-deserved reputation as the most, now that the Israeli army of occupation was in the same position as the British army of occupation had been, and the Palestinians were in the same position that the Jewish underground had been, it seemed to the Palestinians, encouraged by the successful example of the Eigen terrorists under Begin, and the Lehi terrorists under Shammy. The Palestinians tried to imitate their success, hoping that terrorist acts would have the same effect of driving out the Israeli occupiers as the Jewish terrorists had on driving. The plan was a failure, mostly because the rules of the game had changed. Begin and Shammy had now decided that terrorism was a bad thing and loudly and constantly condemned it at every opportunity. Since Israel has unparalleled access to the world media, the Palestinians got a bad press. During the Ford administration, a great deal of time and diplomatic effort were involved in shuttle diplomacy on the part of Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, for the purpose of stabilizing the temporary frontiers of the belligerents in the 1973 war along the ceasefire lines. Unfortunately, little was, or could be, accomplished in resolving the basic territorial issues existing among the belligerents. US policy, also favored by the UN, consisted of making efforts to reconvene the Geneva Conference, at which, hopefully, all parties and issues would be at the negotiating table, so that a comprehensive solution to the Middle East problems could, since the principal issues to be resolved concerned the Palestinian situation, 1, in the West Bank and Gaza, 2, the refugee problem, and 3, the status of Jerusalem, the Palestinians would necessarily have to be represented at any such conference. For this purpose, the Palestinians regarded the Palestine Liberation Organization as their proper representative. Israel, as usual, flatly refused to attend any meeting or conference with representatives of the PLO on the grounds that they were a terrorist organization bent upon the destruction of Israel. The Carter Peace Offensive. As the Carter administration took office in January of 1977, the respective positions staked out by the belligerents had not changed since the end. 1. Israel still occupied the Sinai, the West Bank and Gaza, all of Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights too. Israel refused to return any of the captured territories, with the possible exception of part of the Sinai, on the grounds that the possession of the occupied territories was required in order to provide defensible borders necessary for Israel's security. 3. Under no circumstances would Israel allow a Palestinian state to exist next to it, also for reasons of security. 4. Israel could not and would not give up a single foot of the West Bank and Gaza, because these were part of Eretz Israel, land given by God to Abraham in perpetuity. Hardly anyone outside of Israel considered this last argument as a serious contention and assumed that, since Israel had accepted, or pretended to accept, Resolutions 242 and 338, which called for a return of the occupied territories, it was only a bargaining stance. The main Arab position, in simple terms, was to insist: 1. That the occupied territories be returned pursuant to UN Resolutions 242 and 338, 2. That the West Bank and Gaza be the basis for an independent Palestinian state, 4, 3. That the Israeli settlements on the West Bank were an obstacle to peace, and contrary to international law, which prohibited an occupying power from settling its own citizens on occupied land. Israel's strategy was: 1. To deflect or fend off any peace overtures from any source, by refusing even to appear in the same room with representatives of the PLO, and, 2. To express a ready willingness to negotiate a peaceful settlement of the Palestinian questions, if only there was someone to negotiate with. Begin was even more emphatic in confusing matters. In a memorable statement, he announced that everything is negotiable, but there are certain things he would never agree to. This comment certainly deserves a place beside Samuel Goldwyn's famous remark, "An oral contract is not worth the paper it is written on." As Jimmy Carter's inauguration day approached, January 20, 1977, the media was full of reports proclaiming that the political climate in the Middle East was more favorable for peace than it had been for 25 years, and that the problems of the Middle East were ripe for a solution. Both President Carter and Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, and Zbigniew Brzezinski, National Security Advisor, were eagerly looking to the Arab-Israeli stalemate as an opportunity for a major foreign policy coup. Carter's idealism and Vance's and Brzezinski's experience seemed to complement each other, so that it was thought that the US was in a strong position to accept the leadership of the peace offensive in the Middle East. Accordingly, almost immediately after the Carter inauguration, Secretary of State Vance left on a peace mission to the Middle East. On February 7, 1977, the Wall Street Journal carried a report of Vance's Mideast trip may lead to path for renewal of Arab-Israeli peace talks. Damascus, the Carter administration's first foray into Middle East diplomacy, apparently has produced some new ideas about how to get, but so far, what has come out is more a sense of direction than a specific plan to get Arabs and Israelis into a Geneva conference later this year. And because fresh ideas often fail in this troubled region, this effort too may never produce concrete results. There is a very hard and difficult road ahead, Secretary Vance cautioned at a news conference here early Monday, before he was to return to Washington to report on his trip to President Carter. Some old facts. According to Mr. Vance, his fact-finding journey rediscovered some rather old facts. The main ones are that Arabs and Israelis disagree sharply about the core issues of a possible final Middle East settlement, namely the nature of what peace means, the extent of Israeli withdrawals from occupied territory, and how to settle the PLO still. Secretary Vance professed some muted optimism at the end of "There also seems to be a serious effort underway among Arab leaders to overcome Israel's refusal to have the PLO. At the Geneva conference, which Mr. Vance hopes will begin in the second half of 1977. Israel contends the PLO is merely a terrorist organization without political standing, rather than the sole spokesman of the Palestinian cause, as Arab governments assert publicly. Procedural problem: unfortunately, all this involves mainly a procedural problem that must be settled before a Geneva conference can begin. It does little for the central issues of Middle East peace, which apparently remains as intractable as ever. For example, the Arabs still insist upon complete return of all occupied territory, while Israel, just as adamantly, insists it will never return everything. Thus, the best the Americans hope for this year is to get the negotiation process started. They don't expect any substantial issue to be settled during 1911. On February 14, 1977, the Los Angeles Times published a news item on the Vance trip from which the following excerpt is taken. As Kissinger used to say, and Carter advisors now repeat, moderates are in control in the key Arab states confronting Israel. And this alone presents an opportunity Israel cannot afford to miss. As a result, Israel is